Hello, this is Belinda Rhodes on Monday, the 18th of May. Today, as public anger over the expenses scandal builds, senior MPs tell House of Commons Speaker Michael Martin it's time to go.
I think it's becoming very severe indeed, and I would be surprised if he survives the whole of the week ahead.
The bitter conflict in Sri Lanka appears to be over, but what has happened to the civilians and the Tamil Tiger leadership?
They have been comprehensively beaten by an absolutely ruthless military campaign, which I think they just didn't expect.
And we hear the story of a young migrant worker from Shenzhen whose dreams are shattered as the financial crisis bites in China. But first, the headlines and a look at the papers with Bill Overton.
Commons Speaker Michael Martin will set out plans to reform expenses today in a bid to quell demands for him to quit over his handling of the Westminster scandal. He's due to make an emergency statement just hours after the tabling of a no-confidence motion that could see him become the first Speaker to be ousted in more than 300 years. The Commons authorities, led by the Speaker, blocked several requests in recent years to have expenses details released under Freedom of Information laws. We'll have more on that story in just a moment. Meanwhile, an inquiry will be launched into claims a Labour MP was permitted to claim allowances for mortgage interest he no longer paid. Ben Chapman allegedly benefited by £15,000 over 10 months from the arrangement. He's quoted as saying, "I do not believe I've done anything wrong." President Barack Obama has been heckled as he addressed students at one of the largest Catholic universities in the US amid a row over abortion rights. Protests and vigils were held at Notre Dame in Indiana, with several people arrested before the president's speech. Before receiving an honorary degree, he defended the right to abortion, but said the procedure should be rare. There are approximately 60 million Roman Catholics in the US, with almost half of them supporting abortion rights, research suggests. Employers are increasingly using drug testing to get rid of staff without having to make redundancy payouts, a charity's claiming. Release, which focuses on drugs, the law and human rights, reports fourfold increase in calls to its drug team about workplace testing in the first 3 months of 2009 compared with the same period last year. Many callers have been tested for the first time after years in the same job. Often a programme of voluntary redundancies was announced, followed by workplace medicals for the remaining staff, including a drugs test. Now, for a look at the papers, and the Independent's front page says after 26 years, Sri Lanka claims to have defeated the Tamil Tigers as the rebel group laid down their arms last night. Observers say the government faces a major challenge in dealing with the 300,000 refugees driven from their homes by the fighting. The Sun's front page wants Gordon Brown to call an election now as the only way to rid politics of sleaze once and for all. They quote Oliver Cromwell's 1653 speech to Parliament, which famously concluded, "In the name of God, go." And all the papers report on Liverpool's on-field infighting during their victory yesterday over West Bromwich Albion. The Times says manager Rafael Benitez snubbed Manchester United after the game by refusing to congratulate Alex Ferguson on his team's championship victory. And there's more news and breaking stories throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
It can't have been a very relaxing weekend for House of Commons Speaker Michael Martin, with resentment from politicians about his handling of the MP's expenses scandal finally boiling over. Liberal Democrat leader Nick Clegg was one of the most outspoken yesterday, calling for Mr. Martin's resignation, and other MPs reflected public anger by making it clear they no longer supported the Speaker. A vote of no confidence is expected to be tabled today, and Mr. Martin must surely be seriously considering his next move. I asked Guardian political editor Patrick Wintour to sum up how much pressure there is on the Speaker to go.
I think it's becoming very severe indeed, and I would be surprised if he survives the whole of the week ahead. We've got senior figures now in all three parties calling on him to stand down. We've had the unprecedented step of the Liberal Democrat leader Nick Clegg calling for him to go on the MAR programme yesterday morning. David Davis, the former Shadow Home Secretary, is backing that call for him to go. And as I understand it, Charles Clark, from the Labour side, also former Home Secretary, is going to support moves to get rid of Michael Martin. I'm not absolutely clear whether Charles Clark himself will support a motion of no confidence that's actually being put down by Tory backbencher Douglas Carswell, but he's absolutely making it clear he thinks Michael Martin must go. The reason is that amongst those who are opposed to Michael Martin, they feel he's just the wrong person to try to bang heads together and get some kind of agreements about the way forward on things like MPs' expenses and pay.
And more broadly, going into a new week, Gordon Brown and indeed the other party leaders will want to show that they're back in the driving seat and they're not just sitting by watching all these new revelations coming out. What sort of tone do you expect Gordon Brown to adopt this week? What do you expect from him?
The first thing they're trying to do is to make sure that as many ministers and MPs as possible get their expenses claims out there in the public domain, and so that they're not actually published, arguably in the Daily Telegraph in a form which does that MP no good whatsoever. So the Chief Whip, I think, has given ministers until 6 o'clock tonight to get their forms into him, and so that they can be published. That's just to stop the drip drip from the Daily Telegraph and the damage to Parliament. So that's one thing they're trying to do. The second thing is that, in terms of the Labour Party, there'll be a meeting of its National Executive Committee, and there will be demands there for some kind of action against those MPs who've broken the rules. It'll be hard to do that because many MPs say they haven't broken the rules. The rules were just no good, and that they shouldn't be punished retrospectively for complying with some bad rules. The Conservatives, they'll launch their European election campaign. David Cameron will do that in the North West, and he will get his independent scrutiny panel underway, which is going through Conservative MPs' expense claims and seeing if any of them will now require repayment. And that's going to be a trial of strength between him and some of his own backbenchers. Many of them are reluctant to repay what they regard as legitimate claims. But then what's really driving all this is public opinion. And the MPs know that if they don't repay, they're going to get thrown out at the next election.
And of course, you can keep up to date with that story at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website today, Tanya Gold has the perhaps unenviable assignment of taking part in a British Airways crash simulation exercise. That's at guardian.co.uk/G2. And you can get over-by-over commentary of the second test between England and the West Indies at guardian.co.uk/cricket. The vicious battle in Sri Lanka between government forces and Tamil Tiger rebels appeared to be over yesterday, with the Tigers saying they had decided to silence their guns, and the Sri Lankan military claiming some of the remaining rebels in the conflict zone were blowing themselves up. The government also claimed that tens of thousands of civilians had escaped from the fighting over the weekend. Claims from both sides have been impossible to verify, particularly as a group of Sri Lankan doctors, who had been providing independent accounts of suffering in the area, have not been contactable lately. I spoke to The Guardian's Gethin Chamberlain on the line from Delhi and asked him if the weekend's developments mean the end of the Tamil Tigers.
It's the end of this stage of the war. It's the end of the Tamil Tigers as a conventional military force. And they were extraordinary in that they did manage to put up a military force that held the Sri Lankan army at bay for, you know, 3 decades. They had a naval wing, they had a conventional army, they had a very small air force, which made them unique amongst rebel groups. So, but in terms now of their capability as a conventional force, they're finished. They have been comprehensively beaten by an absolutely ruthless military campaign, which I think they just didn't expect. They have tried repeatedly over the last few weeks to call for ceasefires. They've asked for the international community to intervene. The Sri Lankan government has just said no. We're going to beat you. We're going to beat you militarily. And we will not stop until we've done so. And they have carried that threat out to its final conclusion. Will they continue as a force, as insurgents? Probably. They appear to have sleeper cells in many of the country's towns and cities. The military itself says that it may be another couple of years before they finally wipe them out at all. Ultimately, you still end up with a situation where you really have to have a political solution, because there's still vast differences.
And what do we know of the civilians who were trapped in this zone over the last few days and weeks?
About a month ago, the government was saying there were fewer than 40,000 people in that what they called the no-fire zone, the area that they designated for civilians to go into. It's quite clear, given that maybe 200,000, 250,000 people have come out of that area, that figure was a grotesque underestimation. By Saturday afternoon, the UN was saying there were still between 50,000 and 80,000 people in there. How many came out over the next 24 hours or so? It's almost impossible to put a figure on it. The figures have changed so much.
And let me just ask you about those doctors who'd been working in the area, who had been providing independent accounts of what had been going on, and they don't seem to have been contactable lately. What do we think has happened to them?
One can only hope that those doctors are safe. They have provided a remarkable service over the last few weeks. They've disappeared. The government says it hasn't got them. Tamil sources say that they were picked up, they were detained and are being interrogated. Again, impossible to know. Their phones are dead.
Gethin Chamberlain on the line from Delhi. Coming up later in the programme, we hear what's in store for the second half of the Cannes Film Festival.
European cinema and Asian cinema is going through a particularly good phase at the moment, and Cannes is reflecting that.
But first, Shenzhen in southern China has long been one of the cities driving the economic boom China has experienced over the last decades. Close to Hong Kong, it was selected as the country's first special economic zone, and workers flocked there from other parts of the country to seek lucrative factory work. But the financial crisis has meant plummeting orders, and official figures say 23 million migrant workers are now jobless. As part of a special Guardian series this week looking at modern China and its place in the world, Tanya Branigan has this story of a young woman whose life has recently taken a turn she couldn't have expected a year ago.
I've been living in Shenzhen for nearly 2 years, since 2007. I feel sad living here. I am about to cry a bit now.
Liu Shao is leaving China's manufacturing heartland. She says she's a girl who likes to have fun. There's not much of that here anymore.
I used to earn 2,500 or 2,600 RMB every month, including overtime. It was reduced to 800 after the financial crisis. Sometimes even 700. If you ask for a day's leave, you may only make 700. I couldn't afford to make a living. I spent all my money on food, and I had to borrow money off someone.
Exports are plummeting. Business is bad. She has little choice but to return to her village in Jiangxi, a 10-hour train ride away. Few young people are left there. Like Liu Xiao, they straddle China's two worlds of urban wealth and rural poverty.
There are more opportunities to find jobs in big cities. And you can experience more relationships and learn about more things. I like the weather and the environment in Shenzhen. The worst thing here is the people. They are not friendly at all. They cheat. I have experienced this 3 times.
While Liu Xiao is glad to see her family, she doesn't plan to stay. Even her dad thinks she should probably go back to the city. There are few jobs in Miaochuan, and no shops or cafes or parks.
There's no way I'll stay here and farm. Impossible. It's too tiring. This village hasn't changed in the last 2 years. I've changed a lot. If I stay here for a week, I'll be eager to leave. It's really boring here.
Tanya Branigan reporting from Miaochuan. The Cannes Film Festival has reached its halfway point, and this is usually the time the big stars start flocking in. But this year's Cannes seems to have a little less of the Hollywood glitz than usual, and perhaps a little more content for the serious film buff. From his deck chair on a terrace overlooking the yacht-studded bay, Zan Brooks sums up the atmosphere for us.
It's a little bit of a sedate Cannes, I think, this year. You know, and maybe that's a good thing. Cannes has really sort of gone back to, in theory, what it does best if it's a sort of a serious festival of cinema, and it's gone to the big guns. So, you know, it could almost be seen as the sort of the Jurassic Cannes. You've got all the old sort of dinosaurs from yesteryear here. You've got, you know, people who've won the Palme d'Or before, from sort of Ken Loach to Lars von Trier. You've got Francis Ford Coppola here, who's won the Palme d'Or twice. And then you've got sort of, you know, established talent like Ang Lee, like Michael Haneke, people like that. So it's short on sort of celebrity razzle-dazzle, I think. I think the American contingent is down this year. Quentin Tarantino's film is the only American film, purely American film, that's playing in the main competition. So I think, in terms of sort of star watching and celebrity watching and the whole red carpet side of things, it's a bit more somber than it normally is.
And do you put that down to the recession and people feeling that it would just be a bit tasteless to parade around in fancy dresses at times like this?
Possibly. I think also it may have had something to do with the writer's strike that hit Hollywood last year, which maybe we're seeing the repercussions of now, that there just aren't the number of really good, solid American films to kind of choose between. Or maybe you could split the coin the other way and just say that European cinema and Asian cinema is going through a particularly good phase at the moment, and Cannes is reflecting that.
And what have been the highlights so far, and have there been any flops?
The highlight for me so far has been Jacques Audiard's film The Prophet, which played this weekend, which is a sort of brilliant old-style prison thriller about Corsican gangs and Arab gangs trying to kind of gain control of the criminal underworld from their jail cells. And it's a very long film, it's 2.5 hours long, but it's absolutely superbly wrought and very tense and brilliantly acted by, again, a cast of actors that I really have no idea who they are. I've never really seen them before. Jacques Audiard made a film called The Beat That My Heart Skips a few years ago that I think played well in England in the sort of the art house crowd. And if there was a sense that you know, there was a film that was the front runner, I would normally say so far Un Prophet would be that. But then you have to remember that a French film won last year, Laurent Cantet's The Class won last year, and they may well not give it to a French film again so soon. In terms of flops, I would say it's difficult to pinpoint that, because, you know, the sort of the breadth of response is so broad that I've kind of come out of films thinking that was awful and then spoken to people afterwards who loved it. A lot of people didn't like the Jane Campion film, Bright Star, about John Keats, but you know, Peter Bradshaw, our Guardian film critic, and a lot of other people really loved it, and apparently people on the jury did too. I felt a similar way about the Ang Lee film, Taking Woodstock, where, you know, it's a film about the birth of the Woodstock Festival back in 1969, and it's a very pleasant film. I enjoyed watching it, but it's incredibly unambitious, I thought, particularly after, you know, Brokeback Mountain and Lust Caution.
So is there something coming up this week that everybody's looking forward to?
Well, there's a sense so far that this festival has yet to really catch fire. But, you know, there are guaranteed sparks next week, if nothing else. There's obviously Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, which is a sort of spaghetti western war movie, and Tarantino's always guaranteed to sort of whip up a stir on the croisette. You've got Lars von Trier coming in with Antichrist, a horror movie, which is sort of an odd choice for Lars von Trier, but, you know, and Lars von Trier has a very sort of factious relationship with Cannes and with the jury. And also you've got the French filmmaker Gaspar Noé, who's back with Enter the Void. Now, a couple of years ago, Gaspar Noé was here with a film called Irreversible, which provoked an absolute storm in the theatre here, where people were kind of booing, stamping their feet and storming out, mainly because of a sort of very gratuitous kind of, you know, grim rape scene in it. And apparently his new film, Enter the Void, is just as charged and contentious. So we've got those explosions still to look forward to.
Zan Brooks on the line from Cannes there. The colourful wooden beach hut has long been seen as something quintessentially British, a symbol perhaps of our defiance in the face of that rainstorm that just isn't going to ruin our seaside holiday. More recently, the beach hut has taken on a kind of retro chic that has seen some changing hands for the price of a small London flat. Now a new kind of designer beach hut has gone on sale in Boscombe as part of a local authority effort to transform the Bournemouth suburb into a hip seaside destination. Steve Morris talked to Wayne Hemingway, designer of the new beach pod.
This is a 50s mid-century modern building which was literally right on the sand in Boscombe, in Bournemouth. It had gone into rack and ruin, it had been empty for 15 years, but the integrity of the building was still there, and mid-century modern architecture is something that's being increasingly appreciated by my generation and younger than me. And you know, ahead, you know, Victoriana was probably for the generation after, older than me, and it is, it's just a great design, is the building itself. And so we've brought it back to life, but done it in a very 21st century way, using modern materials, but also still retaining the integrity of the building, but also bringing in a lot of nostalgia and fun into it. And it feels like, when you're in here, it feels like you're on holiday.
So we're sitting in one of these beautiful new beach pods,
yep.
We're going to call them, or they're calling them. What do you make of it?
I think it's a really interesting design building. It's good architecture. And with the Hemingways on board, they've just done something really special and unique. So the future of beach huts from sitting here looks rosy.
So what have we got here? Just talk me through what this what we're looking at.
Well, what we have here is this design of hut goes back to 1909. Our borough engineer, Mr. Dollamore, designed these, and we've got 500 of them, well, near enough. A small number of them, actually go back to that original time. Of course, a lot of the timbers have been changed and stuff, but some of the original features are just as they were 100 years ago. So you've got a really nice contrast. You've got the original huts, the first huts built by a local authority 100 years ago, the traditional beach bungalow, as they were called back then. And of course the Hemingway surf pods, sort of reinventing it for the 21st century.
Well, that's all from this edition of Guardian Daily. The producers were Phil Maynard and Ian Chambers. I'm Belinda Rhodes. Thank you for listening.